The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Kelly McGonigal. Kelly is a health psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University and the author of The Willpower Instinct and The Upside of Stress. Her TED Talk on The Upside of Stress has received over 7 million views. As a leader in the field of science help, Kelly is passionate about translating cutting-edge research from psychology, neuroscience, and medicine into practical strategies for health, happiness, and personal success. Kelly McGonigal, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, The Upside of Stress, was published in 2015, and there's a ton of insights that I want to talk to you about. But reading the book as I sit here, and it's July 6, 2017, this book feels like a prophetic tome that was warning us against the divisive cultural expressions that have become a part of our daily national conversation. I don't think you intended it to be, but do you know what I mean?
I don't exactly know what you mean. I would love to hear more other than, my central message is good luck trying to avoid stress.
Well, yeah, good luck trying to avoid stress is certainly one of them. I'll pull a quote, and I think this speaks to what's going on in the world right now. And the quote is, fear, stigma, self-criticism, shame, all of these are believed by many health professionals to be powerfully motivating messages that help people improve their well-being. And yet, when put to the scientific test, these messages push people toward the very behaviors the health professionals hope to change.
That is true. And actually, I think you just described a cycle that we have found ourselves in psychologically, socially, and politically, that we are using all the wrong levers to basically amplify all of the suffering.
Yes.
Yeah.
So nailed it. I don't know that that's a great thing, but I mean, really, like when I read that, I'm like, that's what's going on right now. That's what we're the screaming at each other. And I had Lauren Duca on, who talks about putting people in the bouncy house of shame and all the stuff that's happening. It's just it is so radically unhealthy. And it's not proving anything. It's just having people dig farther in to where they already stand.
Yes. I mean, it's a perfect example of how often very human instincts can lead us astray. And I think that that actually is one of the main points of the book. And a lot of the work that I do is we have a lot of instincts that don't serve us, but they feel really true in the moment. And one of them certainly is the use of shame and stigma to try to make people more like us or to change people's minds. And that absolutely does not work.
And you have a great example, too, which is the warning on cigarette packages.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So there is some research showing that when you make it very clear that smoking will kill you in horribly gruesome, unpleasant ways, it increases smokers' desire to have a cigarette right then and there. That there is, even though it seems wildly contradictory, that when you make someone aware of their mortality, it often pushes them toward whatever their comfort coping mechanism is. And we see that sort of thing across a lot of psychological science, that when people are feeling scared or uncomfortable or challenged, that they turn towards things that increase their suffering rather than provide a pathway to transformation.
So interesting. I mean, this is one of the things, it comes up a lot because in our field of improvisation, one of the major things that we're teaching is the ability to stay comfortable inside discomfort and to kind of use that. And themes that I was seeing over and over in your book were definitely related to that. But I think it all starts with this idea that we have a mistaken, I'll use your term, mindset about stress. And, you know, you cite a 2014 survey that 85% of Americans agreed that stress has a negative impact on health, family, and work. But your contention is that we're looking at this wrong. We're looking at stress wrong.
Well, we're looking at it incompletely. So it certainly is the case that stress and trauma and crises and all of that can lead to harmful outcomes. But this is a perfect example of the yes and. Yes, that's true. And we also know that stress is positively linked to meaning in life. Mm-hmm. We also know that stress can enhance performance under pressure. We also know that stress can make us more pro-social, can increase our empathy and our caring in some circumstances and depending on our mindset. And what I found is that because we only talk about one side of stress, it leads people to believe that when they are stressed, it's a sign that there's something wrong with them, that they can't cope. It might make them feel that they're the only one, like, I should be able to do this and not be stressed. I should be calm. I should have it all together. And it can lead people to disengage from goals or roles that are really important and meaningful and make it harder to actually harness whatever the potential upsides of stress are. So it's really a matter of being able to hold some of this complexity mm-hmm. so that you can actually harness stress rather than become defeated by it.
So I'm curious, prior to your research, did you carry around the idea that the rest of us have, which that stress is a bad thing?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, I'm trained in psychology and medicine, and stress is the enemy. And not only that, but many of the non-academic worlds that I travel in, like yoga and meditation, mm-hmm. stress is also the thing that people use as the boogeyman, and sort of the promise is whatever I'm telling you, it will get rid of your stress. So sort of every angle of my life experience, I was taught to believe that stress was always harmful. And the only way to create health and happiness is to reduce stress or avoid stress. And one of the things that I became really fascinated by in a lot of my work not related to stress is how helpful acceptance is in allowing for positive transformation. I actually got started out working with chronic pain and difficult emotions like anxiety and anger. And it was so clear from the research that as soon as you accept them as reality, that you can begin to reduce the distress, sometimes even reduce the physical pain, and make room for things that are meaningful and actually engage with life in a much more productive way when you stop resisting them. You know, like the more you try to resist your own anger, the more your blood pressure increases.
Right.
And I've learned about all of these things, about how important it is to accept and then either transform or harness these inner experiences that we think of as being so harmful or destructive. And yet, for some reason, I couldn't apply it to stress until basically the data was smacking me upside the head and saying, pay attention to this. It's stress also. It's even the one thing that you have been convinced all your life you really do need to reduce or avoid.
You also have research that shows optimists live longer than pessimists.
That is true. You know, there are a lot of beliefs that seem to affect longevity and mortality. Uh-huh. Optimism is one of them. Some of my other favorites, we know that if you believe that other people are basically good rather than basically evil, that predicts longevity as well.
Hmm.
We also know that if you have a positive view of aging, you tend to live longer. So it's actually one of the things that I'm fascinated by is how there are certain beliefs that people hold that really seem to interact with their life experience to send them on different trajectories, that those beliefs can propel you towards more effective ways of coping with life or to less effective ways of coping with life. And a lot of these positive beliefs where you sort of your default setting is this can be good or people can be good or that I, you know, have there's something in my life that is meaningful that also is associated with living longer. When your default assumption is one not of negativity, but of possibility or of hope, that seems to be one of the core beliefs that allows you to engage with life more skillfully and change everything from the physiology of how you react under pressure to the things that you're willing to do to invest in your own future and take care of yourself.
I was having a conversation a few weeks back on your campus with one of your colleagues, Tina Seelig, who's awesome. And she's doing some research on luck. And my wife was with me, and she's like, then you need to talk to Kelly because he can find a parking place in any city he's ever in. And Tina was funny because her sort of thing was like, I think it's your optimism because you are looking for a space. You assume a space is going to be there, so you're seeing where the space might be, whereas other people might not even be looking because they're just going to assume it's not there.
So that is exactly how mindsets work. Yeah. And that can seem kind of magical, but mm-hmm. we know that's true for any mindset, that what you expect allows you to attend to reality so that it's still reality. You're not, you know, magically changing the world, but you see things differently in a way that often gives you different opportunities and also will sometimes pull different things out of other people. You know, perfect example, that mindset I mentioned of believing people are basically good versus basically evil, is that when you work from that assumption, people behave in a more trustworthy way. They perceive you in a more positive light. And then you start to construct a different social reality because of your mindset. So I don't know if you can magically create parking spaces, probably not.
No.
But it's a good example of how you will see things that were already there. And then that it's like an upward spiral because then you are interacting with different opportunities. And then, you know, it can push you into situations that would be unavailable if you had a more negative lens.
I was on a panel at Aspen Ideas a couple weeks back, and we were talking about the rules of improvisation and how we create these ensembles, and you have this rule about saying yes and you have to have your partner's back. And the guy from the New York Times running the panel said, well, you know, like, you're not – comedy doesn't attract a bunch of people who are just, like, really good at working together. I'm like, no, not at all. Like, you know, like, no one got into comedy because they're well-adjusted. That is not a prerequisite. It's the opposite. And he goes, well, then what is it? And I go, well, they've given all these rules, and they know they need to behave that way. He goes, are you saying that you can fake it till you make it, that's kind of it? And I'm like, yeah, that is kind of it. And then when I was reading your book, I was sort of like, well, you're talking a bit about that, which is like, you know, if you have this mindset that things are going to work, it is more likely that those things might work.
Yes. And I think that part of it is paying attention to outcomes. So, mm-hmm. you know, people will only follow rules so long as they continue to produce positive outcomes. You have good rules in place. Mm-hmm. And that's why people who maybe don't find that they come naturally will learn to stick with them and adopt them. And the same is true with mindsets. You know, it does not come naturally to me, by the way, to embrace stress and tolerate discomfort. What comes naturally to me is to want to stay in bed like all the time and avoid any discomfort.
Yeah.
And if something scares me, I want to run away and I don't want to experience that fear and discomfort. But what I found is that when I adopt the mindset that says I can handle this, that there are worse things in life than being uncomfortable, that, you know, the anxiety can sometimes be energy that I can actually harness and use, even if that pounding heart feels like I'm panicking. It's still energy that's available to me physiologically. When I start to adopt those beliefs, even though they don't come naturally, I start to find, well, those beliefs are really helpful because then I walk into situations feeling more confident. I actually experience things that build on each other and develop my resources. And so paying attention to outcome is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And when you find a mindset that is truly useful, you'll notice it. You know, it's like one big experiment.
Right. You talk about mindset interventions. Mm-hmm. And the sort of three areas that you talk about are that compromise this are learning, exercising, and sharing. I found this really, really interesting. I want you to dig into this a little bit with me because I feel like in many ways our work does this. You have some sort of knowledge transfer. You have some sort of physical exercise that you are embodying the knowledge. And then the third part is this idea of sharing, which is something that we do with, you know, we're in conversation with our audiences. We're a school as well as a theater. There's all this sort of sharing of the concepts and the exercises and the games. And it creates what I find to be a very healthy system for creativity. When you're talking about learning, exercise, and sharing, how do you mean it in the context of a mindset intervention?
Yeah, so this comes from research trying to basically instill new positive mindsets in people who might be operating from beliefs that are not helping them.
Mm-hmm.
So a classic example is a belonging mindset intervention, where a lot of people walk into a new situation wondering if they belong, thinking they might not fit in, maybe they don't have the right stuff to succeed, that they will expose themselves as a fraud or fail in some way. And most people also think that they're the only one having that feeling. And so a classic belonging mindset intervention will educate people about the fact that anyone who's not a narcissistic sociopath is probably going to have those thoughts and feelings. Mm-hmm. Maybe show some survey data. Maybe you'll hear other people who seem to be quite successful and have everything together talk about their own experiences of feeling like an imposter or worrying about fitting in. So you're getting some of that data, you're learning. And then you're asked to maybe try it on, see if it's consistent with your own experience. So maybe remember a time in your life when that was true for you. But this extra step of sort of saying is believing and thinking about someone who might benefit from this knowledge. So in a classic belonging mindset intervention, you might be asked to record a video message to someone who's going to be coming into this new situation next year, who is going to be having all of these thoughts and feelings. And what would you say to them to help them and encourage them? And so you find yourself having to actually think about this new belief and communicate it in the interest of serving others. And I really believe it's that last piece that is what makes mindsets stick, is when it's no longer just about serving yourself, but you really see this idea as something that allows you to support others. And mindset interventions that skip that step are just not as effective.
One of our scholars at the University of Chicago was telling me about research on people who give advice, and really that it was a much more positive experience for the person who is giving the advice than the person who's getting, right? And that's kind of what you're saying, right? So it's it's being pro-social to your own self in that regard.
It is. I mean, there's even research showing that if you want to give yourself advice, you should do it in the second person. So I would say to myself, Kelly, I know you're feeling really scared about this, but you can do it. Because there's something about having to step outside yourself for a moment that really allows this process to be more effective.
Let's talk about talking to yourself, because this came up in your book and I had to laugh, because about two summers ago we had a group of scholars who were all interested in comedy and want to come in and sort of jam and talk to us. So I hosted them for 2 days, and one of the women and I got into a conversation because I said, you know, I give a lot of keynote speeches, and I, even though I'm good at it and I've done it for a long time, I get nervous. And Allison Wood Brooks said, you need to say I'm excited about giving the speech rather than I'm nervous. And literally, I have passed this advice on to a ton of people, and you talk about it in your book, but it does make a difference when you say I am excited rather than I am nervous.
It does. It makes a difference. And you know, the fascinating thing about stress is that it is so close to emotional experiences that we want to have. Physiologically, it looks like excitement. It looks like flow. It looks like joy. It looks like courage. All of these things are variations of a stress state. Even social connection has elements of stress physiology built into it. And it seems like as soon as you kind of choose your own adventure and decide to label what you're feeling with a particular emotion that is very close to what you might be experiencing in this moment as anxiety or stress, you actually begin to create physiological changes that push you in the direction of that desired state. And so that's been shown with that little mindset intervention you just mentioned, that when people who are feeling anxious choose to view their own stress response as energy they can harness, it starts to change that physiology in a way that actually gives them more energy, more fuel, more confidence, makes it a healthier state of stress. And I feel like this is a really important message that you know, when you're feeling anxious or when you're feeling overwhelmed, you're very close physiologically to a state that you might aspire to. And it's fascinating how the body will follow the mind when you set an intention.
Right. And you talk a lot about storytelling, which it was a surprise to me. And then as I read more, it made perfect sense. I wrote down here a quote, writing about your values is one of the most effective psychological interventions ever studied.
Yes, because it changes the way that you interpret life. So if you know what's meaningful to you, and every day you reflect on that, I actually will not get out of bed in the morning until I've thought, what value do I think I'm going to have the greatest chance to express today, or will be challenged the most today? Because I know what my core values are, but maybe, you know, today enthusiasm feels really important, or compassion feels like it's going to be called for. And then when you have that clarity, suddenly when you're in a stressful situation, like someone is being rude to you, but you're clear what your values are, then that's the opportunity to bring forward your sense of humor or your compassion. And it basically becomes the lens through which you process, especially difficult circumstances. And then again, that changes the meaning of the situation. It changes your behavior. It brings out your strengths. When people ask me, you know, what's something I should do, that is at the top of the list, to get clear on what your values are. And again, to be clear that those are things that matter to you, the sort of what you want to bring to life, what you want to experience. They're not things you evaluate yourself on. And sometimes people get tripped up on that. They think, oh, you know, what do other people admire in me? Well, no, it could be something that you think you suck at, but it's really important to you, mm-hmm. and therefore you value it. And every moment in life could be an opportunity to strengthen something that you feel right now is actually not a strength.
We had this moment in Aspen. So we were there talking about a program that we've developed with a group called Caring Across Generations that's looking to provide improvisation to caregivers. Huge issue that's going to just get worse the next 20 years. And the final exercise, and my wife was leading the workshop, the final exercise she had was we split people into pairs. They needed to start telling their caregiving story to the person across from them. And once they got a few sentences in, it was the job of the other person to repeat back to them what was just said before they shared their story. And about halfway through the exercise, Anne turns to me, she's like, listen to this noise. It's like a warm noise. And indeed, when we unpacked this, this man very emotionally raised his hand and goes, I know that's how I'm supposed to talk and listen, and I know I don't do it. And I think the salient thing here is our stories are so important, and we get it educated out of us, or work takes it out of us, or we lose practice with it, that we have to tell these stories and we have to listen to other people's stories. To go back to our very first beginning of this conversation, right? No one is listening to each other.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the reasons that people are bad at listening to other people's stories is this mindset that they can't handle stress. We know that when you care about someone, you will have an empathic stress response. And so often people try to shut down the stories that people are telling because they can't handle the feeling of discomfort or anxiety or sadness that's coming up in them. And so they try to solve the other person's problems, or they try to shift it back to themselves, or sometimes they disappear and they sort of leave someone's life in a moment when they're most needed because they can't handle their own feelings of sympathetic or contagious stress. And so one of the things that I think is so important about embracing stress is that part of it also allows us to be more social and more caring and connected, because we become a big enough vessel to hold the other person's stress and our stress about their stress, so we can really listen. And that presence, just that ability of saying, I am strong enough to hold what I'm feeling about your stress or your pain, becomes healing to the other person without having to say the right thing or without having to fix any problems. And that's there's an element of trust to that, but that you discover when you slow down and really listen.
I'm curious, what was the medical community's response to this book and your work? Doctors, nurses, did you get feedback from them, positive or negative, on this?
I have gotten mostly positive feedback from the medical community, in part because physicians are extremely stressed and they recognize certain aspects of this message that say they do really good work under pressure. And so they have been more open to other aspects that they might not be as fully knowledgeable about, like the idea that sometimes stress is bigger than yourself and your stress response is going to try to nudge you to connect with others, to ask for help, to admit that you need help. That's part of the biology of our stress response. And that's not a weakness, that's a strength. I found that the people who have the most difficulty with this are actually psychologists, like myself, because we are just so comfortable talking about stress as the enemy, and everything in psychology is sold under the label of stress reduction. And it's really difficult. I mean, you know, the thing is, I came out with this TED Talk in 2013. I had already been spending years trying to grapple with this. Mm-hmm. And now writing the book years later, I've had like a decade to come to terms with the fact that the way that I was viewing stress was probably not the most skillful and helpful. And I understand that when you first hear this message, by the way, when you tell people that their stressful lives are killing them, that may not actually be the most useful message to give people who cannot control the stress in their lives or cannot go back and erase the adversity in their past. But it can take a while to figure out, what am I supposed to say and what is the mindset that's helpful, that acknowledges the complexity of stress, the upside and the downside.
Really interesting. There is another aspect to this that you talked about with regard to social media. And I like your phrase. I think you said it was putting on a positive show, and that can actually have negative effects on us.
Yeah, I mean, when we're really trying to portray our lives as ideal, and we believe that we shouldn't be having difficulties or struggles, you know, we can curate our lives visually on Instagram or however on Facebook, and then people begin to misperceive how normal their own struggles are. I think it's actually wonderful when people post stories of everyday calamities on Facebook rather than, you know, the perfectly, you know, wonderful picture of the best possible moment of the day. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that helps us be good at stress is to recognize the common humanity of it, that every day is full of stressful moments. It doesn't take away from the positive moments. And if you're struggling, you aren't the only one. And I think it's quite dangerous to think that we have to manage our image, particularly with people who are supposed to already care about us, and how that can cut us off from the support that we might need, or keep other people from telling us when they're struggling.
I tell people all the time that there would be no comedy if there were no fiascos. Like,
That's right. There's
no one wants to hear a story about everything going right. That all of comedy is pretty much saying everything that's gone wrong. There was another, and this was very interesting to me, and kind of a nuanced conversation in your book, because it was about Mark Seary and his work around resilience.
Mm.
And what I found fascinating about this, because the premise here that adversity can create resilience, I buy into that completely, but you also talk about the negative response that Mark got on this with mm-hmm. people sort of saying, like, what are you promoting, you know, terrible things to happen to people?
Yeah, it's interesting. So what I found, I learned this very early when I started talking about the so-called upside of stress, is people think that it is dismissing the reality of suffering. And that was a surprise to me, because I actually, you know, with the work that I do and the communities I work with, to me, I take it for granted, the reality of suffering and trauma and, mm-hmm. and all of that. And yet people, when they hear someone say something like, even if you've experienced great suffering, that it can change you in ways that you ultimately value, and it can be put in service to something that you value, even though part of us understands that that is obviously true, that's the hero's journey. There's another part of us that is like, wait a minute, are you saying that this should have happened to me? Mm. Are you saying that I should be grateful for this loss or this abuse or this disaster? And we hear a lot of things embedded in that feel like a lack of empathy or compassion. And again, it comes back to the idea we were talking about, of being able to hold opposites and complexity. Mm. It can absolutely be the case that you dedicate your entire life to trying to prevent suffering, and at the same time see people's natural capacity for growing from adversity, that they can both be true at the same time. And that, in fact, it actually, I think, the only way to deal with the complexity of the world we live in is to believe that both are possible.
Yeah, that was that came in really helpful today. I had a conversation with a friend who was just in a bad place and just looking for like some feedback. And I talked about this idea around post-traumatic growth, you know, and the idea that, you know, this can be a mindset and this is an opportunity for you because, yes, it is a challenge. But, you know, nothing great emanated. I mean, that is where all the great stuff emanates from, those challenges. And you just have to sort of, you know, change your mindset at looking at that. And they were actually like, yeah, OK, I buy that.
That's an interesting challenge. I will say, I usually tell most people, post-traumatic growth is a mindset that you cultivate for yourself rather than you try to impose on others.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly the moment when people are most likely to reject it, when they're telling you their story because they want empathy and compassion, and you whip out the whole, you're going to grow from this. Sometimes
yeah.
It does not land so well.
Not always.
But when it's you yourself choosing mm-hmm. to cultivate that, it can mm-hmm. be, you know, a life raft. So that's a tricky balance to find.
Yeah, totally. All right. This has been a great conversation. We end the podcast by always asking our guest if they have a yes and story. So a time in their life or their work where they normally would have said no, but instead they said yes and what happened. Do you have one of those stories for us?
I do. And it's a big turning point in my life. And it reflects the way that Yes End works in my life. So I know that Yes End is often about sort of not rejecting other people out of hand or mm-hmm. not dismissing ideas. But for me, I'm most likely to say no when I think something bad could happen and I want to avoid it. And that's sort of like my default way of operating. So I'll say no in advance to avoid the discomfort. And when I was in graduate school, after my first year, I'd had a really successful first year, but I was planning on quitting the program because I just was consumed with the sense that at some point I was going to fail. It was going to be too hard. There was so much pressure. Half of my cohort had actually quit already, so I had a lot of role models for people leaving Stanford. And I just was convinced I was going to do it. I'd even told my advisor, and he told me to take a couple months and think about it. Mm-hmm. And I was taking a mindfulness class where they introduced the idea of different relationships with fear or other emotions. And we actually embodied it as like an improv exercise where we would practice pushing away, mm-hmm. and that didn't work. They would just push back. Mm-hmm. We practiced running, and running, they just would run after you and never end. And then the teacher pulled me up and said, what if you danced with it? And he like grabbed me in a tango hold and started dancing. It's like, you can do anything as long as you're just dancing with it. And for me, I don't know why it was that. That was sort of my yes and moment where I thought, well, things aren't awful yet. And if I'm okay with either outcome, why don't I just dance with the program? So I'll say yes to it. Mm-hmm. And I'm keeping my options open. And I'm going to do it my way and see if I can find more joy in this. Rather than feel like there's only one right way to do it. And if I can't get it perfect, I shouldn't do it at all. And that was huge for me. I mean, obviously, it worked out because I have a PhD after my name. But it also, it taught me that there are a lot of options in any moment where if I might sort of anticipate that I can't succeed or that something will be really difficult and uncomfortable, that I don't have to trust that intuition or let it make the choices for me.
It also gave you a great title for your next book, which you could call Dance With It.
You know, my next book is actually about the joy of movement. So I'm hoping I will get dance in the title.
That's awesome. Kelly McGonigal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.